In classical music, pianist Lucy Parham is a well-known and much-loved performer, combining her love, piano music composers, with an innate ability to tell their stories not only at the keyboard, but via the spoken word too. The piano winner of the Young Musician of the Year back in 1984 is celebrated for her explorations of the lives of Robert Schumann, Clara Schumann, Chopin, Debussy, and for collaborating with actors and actresses including Simon Russell Beale, Roger Allam, Sheila Hancock, Neve Cusack and Rosamund Pike in both recordings and live performance. Her Elegy Rachmaninoff album forms the basis of a special concert in this year's London Piano Festival, with actor Tim McInerney telling the story whilst Lucy navigates the twists and turns of the composer's fiddly scores. This combination of words and music is a tried and tested format that deftly brings to life human beings whose language is universal and skill both magical but disappointingly out of grasp for the rest of us. Lucy and I began our conversation for this podcast with a memory from her school days. Take a moment. Do you remember what you were doing when you were 8 years old?
Well, my mum used to play the piano in the evenings, and I found that very soothing. I was probably the musical equivalent of being read a bedtime story when you, because it was the only time she had in her day to play. And so she'd be trying to learn a new Chopin nocturne or something like that. So it would just stick in my head. And actually, I went to the Hughie Menion School for 6 months. That's a story for another time. But when I went, I was 8 and I did not have perfect pitch. And we used to have to get up at 6:30 every morning to do an hour's oral dictation before breakfast. I know.
What? So somebody would just play something and then you'd have
Play something on a piano and we'd all sit there with a pencil and they'd say, write it down, like chorales and things like that. Well, can you imagine? I was 8.
That sounds terrifying.
I think I might have scraped through grade 5 theory with the pass mark by then. That was about my level of... And I didn't have perfect pitch. And I went to the school in the January and I left in the July just to go back to I felt happier in a regular school. It was nothing against the menu school, but it just wasn't right for me at that time in my life. However, when I left, I had perfect pitch. Now, whether they brought that to life or whether I had it and it was dormant or whether I learned it, that I don't know. But I'm very grateful for that because it really stood me in good stead. And that made the earworms even worse because then the earworms were in tune.
Wow. I just had to wait for the door. There's somebody. My partner is in the other office and that door doesn't shut quite so well. It's fine. It's stopped now. We'll edit this out. Maybe. But at 8 years old, to be asked to transcribe Bach chorales. I mean, that's... I just about remember 8 years old. Geez, that must have been... Was it intense?
It was terrifying, because I thought I was the only person there who couldn't do it. And I don't know if I was, probably not, but it seemed like it. And I was the youngest person in the school at that point as well, because it's a very small school. Mm. And
do you know any of the people who were in that class now?
Yes, I do, actually. Tasmin was my... I shared a room with Tasmin Little, and Kathy Stott would have been in that class a little bit older, and Amanda Hurton, and, you know, I still have contact with them all. I must ask
what them. Happened to them?
I know. Shame they
yeah.
Off,
yeah,
they?
I bet they haven't got perfect pitch.
Oh, no, I bet they haven't.
Sorry. We are talking today because... of the London Piano Festival, which you are in, and you're playing Rachmaninoff in it. Is that right?
I am. You're completely right.
Hurrah.
I'm very excited to go back to this wonderful festival run by Charles Owen and Katia Apekishova. I must get that right.
Nicely done.
And they have very kindly put my show Elegy, which is for... It's a show I created about Rachmaninoff's life with an actor in this occasion, Tim McInerney, who narrates Rachmaninoff's words, and it's a script I've put together. That is the nutshell version of the concert.
What energizes you about Rachmaninoff? I'm going to see if we meet in the middle on this.
Are you not a Rachmaninoff
No,
fan?
I'm not saying that I'm not a Rachmaninoff fan, far from it, but I just wonder whether, maybe that wasn't the right expression, I wonder whether we'll share the same passions for him.
For me, the overriding thing about Rachmaninoff is the way he goes straight to the heart. And he is obviously a great melodist. I was thinking about this morning and I thought, is he the greatest creator of melody since Schubert? I'm trying to think of who else one might. And after we've had this conversation, of course, somebody very obviously comes to mind. So I say that with a caveat. But melody and the harmony, and it's so lush. But I think sometimes with a composer, you can feel the composer through their music. Like I do feel with Schumann, for instance, I feel connected to Schumann, the man, through his music. And I feel the same about Rachmaninoff. I feel connected to him through his music. With Chopin, I love Chopin. I play a lot of Chopin. I'm not sure that I'm wiser about him as a human being through his music. So I feel a connection to Rachmaninoff's music like that. And of course, we're lucky to have many of his own recordings to listen to. So it gives us more of a guide. Because I do think there is a danger in over-romanticising his music, because obviously it's very romantic music. It's not schmaltz, and that's
no,
it.
It's not. No, okay. There
I
is.
I don't know if we meet in the middle of any.
Yes, we do. There is an immediacy in his musical language, which also retains some integrity and some ambiguity. That's how I would describe it. As in, it's really appealing, but also it leaves you asking questions at the end of it, which is kind of what I would expect. What I would hope for from a composer.
I would agree. And I think also that if maybe you only knew the Second Piano Concerto and C-sharp minor prelude, and the great works in themselves, but the very famous ones, you know, then to go to pieces like, you know, the Vespers or the Bells or the Isle of the Dead, and there's another much darker side there as well that is absolutely to be explored. I think it's not just the huge sweeping melodies, and that there's more to be looked at.
What do you think that you know about him, or you feel as though you know about him as a result of that music?
I think from the reading I've done and combined with the music, I think he was a very private man. I think it's hard to get to know him. And funnily enough, I feel I know him more through the music than through his letters. There's one particular sentence that I love, which is when he says that I'm generally regarded as a silent man, so be it. In silence lies safety.
Makes me feel rather sad.
Sad. But then he would have to have become silent at quite a young age. And of course, he lost his beloved house. Ivanovka was burnt down by the Bolsheviks, had to remain quiet, escape. He didn't care for the life in America much and didn't like all the, he said he didn't like all the socializing that he had to do as a composer and a musician that was required. And of course, is required now. But I think he preferred to be private. He liked his family to be around him, but he wasn't a showman and he didn't really enjoy that. And I feel some of that does come out in the music, especially in the more introverted, you know, some of the preludes and actually a piece like Isle of the Dead. I mean, if there is anything more lugubrious, but I'm slightly obsessed with that piece at the minute.
There is, I don't know if it's an irony or a paradox, I'm never really clear, but a lot of the things that people know him most for, that he is most well known for, is the music that requires a showman or a show person, if you will. So at the same time as not necessarily wanting to be that kind of individual, he was writing material for himself to play, which demonstrated his considerable technique.
Absolutely. And I think that, yes, when you're playing his pieces, you can feel the size of his hand and the, for me, I've got quite a large hand for a woman, but not, you know, when you see some of these, you know, men with huge hands and hand span, and you can realize for him to play those things, it was quite easy. But I do think it's interesting, some of the more introverted, well, some of them I include in the program, actually, because like the E-flat prelude that he wrote when his first daughter was born, and it's such an outpouring of love and tenderness, and it's very intimate. And you don't maybe, and the melody there, again, stunning, you don't maybe associate that with, you know, the finale of the third piano concerto or something. It's, but yet written by the same person. And of course, very influenced by Chopin, you know, as a miniaturist in that way.
Do you think that he was aware of, yeah, if we agree that he was able to craft a great melody and set it in a hugely appealing way, do you think that he was aware of that skill, or it was just something that he did anyway? Do you know what I mean? Was he aware of his impact?
I do know what you mean. No, I think that was just his voice. I think that is what he did. So hard, isn't it, to know how aware composers are of what they're doing. Sometimes we, you know, as musicians, and you know, we take a score and we pick it to pieces and we look at the inversion of this and put this here, and then right, and then you think how much of that was conscious by the composer, and how.
But
much
I just wonder. Conscious. But was he aware of its? Well, maybe a better question to ask first of all is: were his new works then as popular with audiences as they are now? With audiences.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, it's very interesting about the, certainly the critical reception of the symphonic works was not good. I mean, the first, well, as you know, the first symphony was absolutely panned by the critics. And I think there was some suggestion that, I think it was Glazunov, wasn't it? that he might have been drunk. And then it was panned. And then he wrote the second symphony, and then they said the first symphony was good. Then when he wrote the third, he said the second was good. But in his lifetime, it didn't get great reviews. But I think what is interesting about his music is that has stood the test of time in a way that one might not have expected, because of this popular music that it was considered to be, you know, very melodic and luscious. But we still love it. But I think that's fascinating. We are told we shouldn't, because times have moved on.
Do people still say that then? I don't know.
I think there's still a little bit of snobbishness. Is that a word?
Yes.
Snobbishness about his music. Oh, it's Phil. Which, of course, there shouldn't be. And he did obviously get very fed up with playing the Prelude in C sharp minor. That I think he would like okay. Never play it again. But the public, when he was playing in the States, the public were clamoring for his own pieces. But then it went slightly out of fashion. And I think we are back, especially with this anniversary this year. But I've always encountered a little bit of, you know, we all know certain well-known pianists who are a little bit snobbish about playing Rachmaninoff, who shall be not known.
Yeah, thank you for that. Was there you've referred to the confidence issue following, well, not just the confidence issue, I mean, he essentially had a nervous breakdown, didn't he, after the first symphony. Yeah. Did he experience that same creative block with piano music, or was it simply just around large-scale orchestral works? Was there a...
No, it was composing in general. He just couldn't compose, and went to see Nikolai Dahl, who gave him hypnosis. And as he says in his letters, you know, he heard the same formula repeated every day to him. You know, you will write your concerto, you will write with great ease, the concerto will be of excellent quality. And he did write it, and he was so indebted to Mr. Dahl that he actually dedicated the piece to him. And there is some suggestion, this may be very well known, that I think he was an amateur viola player, and the second movement, of course, has got a lot of beautiful viola parts in it, and that it's a little bit of an homage to Monsieur Dahl. So,
but when he did return to composing, do you see any, you know, is there any, do you see that development in his solo piano writing? Is there a sense of when he returns to composing that he's doing so tentatively, or does he, even in his soloistic writing, as in the recital music, is there a sense that, no, he returns to it with great gusto and confidence?
He does, and I think if you compare the first piano concerto with the second piano concerto, they are both equally dramatic, virtuosic, have beautiful melodies. Actually, I don't know why the first isn't played more often, but you don't notice any deterioration in the composition after the hymn. I think he was just in a creative lull with everything that was going on in his life, and he needed that to bring him back to life. But of course, when he was in America, there was a long period of time in which he didn't compose. He was playing, earning a lot of money, and it was only when he went back to Switzerland to his house, Sinau on Lake Lucerne, which I'm sure you know he named it after him and his wife. So it's Sinau, so it's Sergei and Natalia Rachmaninoff, which is very romantic. Mm-hmm. And then there he wrote Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini and the symphonic dances and everything. But he'd had a long period of many years where he really hadn't been composing in the States. So for him, composing definitely has gone in sort of creative periods and then not. But in America, he had to perform to earn money. And a lot he earned because he bought a lot of houses. And speedboats. He loves speedboats and motor cars.
Hello.
He had another side to him that we don't know much about, but he did love these things.
He was a thrill seeker.
Yeah.
Wow.
In his private life, which he kept very private.
We talked a lot about orchestral works. What about pieces for solo piano?
Well, there's a beautiful set of six pieces, the Momol Musico, which he wrote before he left Russia, and they're not played so often. They're bigger pieces than the Preludes, with the exception of two. They're all longer, they're difficult, and should be played more often. And in fact, I do play three of those in my elegy show. And people often say, that's a beautiful piece. It's so dark and I didn't know it. And so those are really worth looking at. And then you've got the early pieces that were very much inspired by Chopin, the first opus 3 set, which has got the elegy and the famous C-sharp minor prelude, and you can definitely hear his love of Chopin, especially in the elegy. I mean, that's basically a rather over romantic Chopin nocturne. The transcriptions of Liszt and Liebesfreude, the Kreisler pieces. You've got the variations on the theme of Chopin, variations on the theme of Corelli. And these, again, are not played so much. and they are fantastically and daringly harmonic as well, in a way that maybe we didn't see in the preludes.
Me seeing something tricky is different from somebody like you seeing something tricky. What is, because I'm not a professional pianist, that's the point I'm trying desperately to make, but what is it that is tricky about it? And does that manifest itself as, oh my God, I'm not going in that, or you know, how does it manifest itself?
Well, actually, when you said that, when I first looked at that piece, I thought, oh, I'm not playing that. That's far too difficult. And the trouble is, it fitted so perfectly. I can't give it away because it is a highlight of the program.
Okay, right.
It would be a shame to give away why it's placed where it is. But it had to go there because there was absolutely no alternative. So I thought, it's 10 pages of, well, the first two pages are all right. After, it gets progressively what I call fiddlier. And I don't have that kind of, my hands are built to play Brahms, stuff like that. They're not what I call tricksy fingers. Do you know what I mean? In and out of the keys.
I see.
They don't do that very well.
Does this suggest that all of your fingers need to move independently? I mean, I know all of your fingers do need to move independently. But yes, you're not playing straight chords. There's loads of independent movement.
Yes, and it's fiddly. The stretches are very big. And there's a lot of sort of, it's really hard to describe in words, but there's a lot of in and out and hand position changes and jumps. And a lot of very fast passage work in the cadenza-y bits. It's just fiddly. And a similar idiom to the Paganini Rhapsody, and very difficult to play. I think actually that they get harder as he gets older and composes more, I think. I play Liebesleiter in this and in the show, and because we talk quite a lot about his relationship with Chrysler, so it fits him very well. But it is fantastically...
It sounds like gymnastics.
It's gymnastics. It doesn't fit well under my hand. For some people, it may fit perfectly under their hand. Whereas, I mean, for instance, everyone said to me, oh, Brahms' First Piano Concerto, which was a piece I longed to play, and it was so difficult. And I'm not saying it's not hard. And like, this is taking the musical part. It's monumental. If you're just talking about the physicality of playing the piece, I actually didn't find it that difficult. Not compared with the Paganini Rhapsody, Rachmaninoff, because it's a certain type of technique that suits my style better. It's just easy. I'm not saying it's easy. It's not.
No, you have clarified that.
It's easier to play the notes of that for me. So I had a lot of practice. Paganini Rhapsody, I personally think is the hardest.
Now, that's interesting. I was about to ask you about that because, obviously, because of the podcast that you listened to before we met up today, because I remember asking Tom Poster that and Christina at the time. And there was, I mean, this now feels like years ago. I can't remember when we recorded it. But I remember sort of saying, well, it sounds really difficult to me. And I remember, I think it was Tom who said, well, it's not really. No, you just sit at the keyboard and just play some stuff. And that's my memory of what he said. But you're telling me something different that you...
For me, you see, there we go. And Tom's a friend and a wonderful pianist, great colleague. But I find a second concerto not as hard as the Paganini Rhapsody, but I think there are many parts of the second concerto. In fact, I have another illustrious colleague who I won't name who thinks the second concerto is harder than the third concerto. So it's so much, you know, horses for courses. But I think also the second concerto is fiddly. But the best thing Rachmaninoff does in the second concerto is that he gives himself his own homemade warm-up. So for the first kind of four pages, you can't really hear what the pianist is doing at all. And he admitted he was very nervous in playing. So instead of having to wait, like in a Mozart concerto, you know, you've got to wait for your exposition and then you're sitting there thinking, oh, yeah, it's nearly me. You're straight in with chords that are quite easy to play. And then the orchestra's got the melody and you're kind of doing arpeggios that nobody can really hear. So it warms you up in public. It's brilliant.
It's like you're playing tutti piano, like you're almost...
It's just like that. Whereas Paganini Rhapsody, you're straight in with... And even then, each version is a little harder than the last one. And he saves the worst till last. Second piano concerto. Because I remember Tom said in your podcast, by the time you get to the Cody, you've done all the hard work, which you have in the second concerto. But in the Paganini Rhapsody, the last 3-4 minutes of that are the hardest writing with huge leaps. And so it's not even like you can just enjoy the last 3 minutes.
There's a lot more jeopardy in the Paganini variations.
There's really a lot. I remember playing that piece in Festival Hall for a live Radio 3 broadcast, and I think that possibly was one of the most nerve-wracking moments.
What do you think, Rachmaninoff? I realise I'm asking you to read a dead man's mind, but what?
Never a problem.
It means that you can just speculate to your heart's content. What do you think his motivation was for making it more difficult? If he didn't really like being a showman, why would you write something that was progressively more difficult? And as you got older in your compositional life, things became more difficult. I don't get that.
But it wasn't difficult for him. I mean, have you seen pictures of his handspan?
No, I haven't.
It's like twice mine.
So it was just about, I can do this, so I will, so I'll write it.
Exactly.
He wasn't writing for other pianists. He was only writing for himself. Okay. That's... I don't know why that's made me laugh. That's very helpful. Are there any other pieces that you would, aside from what you're playing in the concert, are there any other sort of works, that solo works, that you'd say go to in order to get a sense of, you know, core Rachmaninoff?
We haven't mentioned the Etude Tableau, which are not conventional etudes. I mean, they do, in the way that the etudes preceded them, like Chopin, for instance, they do tend to focus on a certain type of technique, but they really are picture pieces. And some of them subsequently had the titles to them. The one I play in this is I think possibly set, the idea was it was set at a fair near Moscow, and you can hear all the life of the fair and people scurrying around and buying food and so it was sort of busy day. But some of them have got these titles, but they're really beautiful. And I think probably of all of his solo piano pieces, they are the most underrated and possibly least played on the concert platform. They're hard to play. There are two sets of them and they're quite long to play as a set. But definitely I would say to anyone, if you haven't heard them, there are some great recordings out there. I think Ashkenazi got a beautiful recording of it. And there are many, many to listen to, but they're worth delving into. Actually, again, especially the slow ones, because they're these big vistas, tableau of you feel you're in the heart of the Russian countryside, and especially in winter, there's a bleak sadness to them that again goes straight to the heart, but not with a schmaltzy kind of way. That it's much deeper than that. So I'd really recommend That's a very long answer to your very good question.
No, I mean, I'm responding well to the phrase bleak sadness. That really resonates for me, which is just a reflection of myself, I suspect. Yeah. There is one other thing that has popped into my head that I was thinking about before, which is I have this sort of vague idea that when he was performing, I could be wrong about this, it's not based on evidence, but when he was performing, perhaps there was no one around in the world performing, playing at the piano keyboard like him, and that people had never heard anything like him before. Is that, have I dreamt that, or is there something in that?
Well, I think, I mean, he was the last of the great composer pianists. The last time people would have heard that level of compositional genius and piano as well would probably have been Liszt. And we know how much how popular was Liszt, but of course Liszt had such a different character. He was ever the showman, and Rachmaninoff was not that. And Horowitz, I suppose, once, but not a composer, but looking at that kind of type of technique. I've now forgotten your question.
I just wondered whether at the time when he was playing, whether his celebrity state, whether he had an element of celebrity about him because there was nobody else around playing like him.
I think that's probably true. I think he on the piano and Kreisler on the violin, and that was, yes, the end of an era, and we've never had anything quite like that since.
And maybe, and so therefore, maybe that sort of that person who was quite private and shied away from showmanship made him all the more sort of attractive as a personality, because there's nothing more alluring, I think, if that's the right word, as someone who is able to display great virtuosity but sort of be quite almost detached from it.
I think that's very true, and I think it's true of many things in life, isn't it? Sometimes you meet somebody and they say very little about themselves, and then you find out later they were a Nobel Prize winning scientist or something, and they hadn't told you.
Yeah, because they didn't need to.
They didn't need to. And I think, I know it's a strange comparison to make, but I think there is something with that. He didn't like it, and he didn't find it necessary, and he disliked it in others. And that's why I think his friendships lasted a long time, his family lasted a long time, and the people with whom he played chamber music, and Charlie Arpin, he toured a lot with as a singer, Kreisler, these were very special relationships for him. And I think he was a very serious musician. So I think your point is entirely right, that the need was not there.
Would he have been, I'm sorry to keep asking you this, but you know, you have a clearly close connection with him as a result of your research. Do you think he's someone that you would have liked being in the company of?
Oh, I would have loved him. I would have found him absolutely fascinating. I'd love to have asked him questions. And in fact, a lot of the research I've done has come through, you know, journalists, so newspaper articles and things, which he didn't really like doing. And for that quote I said about "in silence lies safety," that pretty much sums up his whole life. I would love to have met him. Him and Schumann were my two composers I would just adore to meet and sit at a table with, but sadly it's not going to happen.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say that I haven't asked you about?
I suppose the only thing is if one went back to the show itself, I don't want people to think it's academic, and you could come to this and have no knowledge of classical music at all. You could come because you think, oh, I'd like to see Tim McInerney on the stage. I hate this word, taken on a journey, but I can't think of a better way of describing that. What I hope to do with these shows is bring the, you know how we had at school the bust of the composer on a dusty shelf, and there was Beethoven or something. I like to bring that person off the dusty shelf and turn them into a human being who has suffered everything like we have, loss, love, poverty, success, all these different things. And of course, with him, with Exile, and it hopefully brings him over as the human being he was, not just his music, with the two, the words combined with the music. So hopefully, people would cut, they wouldn't think, oh, I don't want to come to that because I'm not really into classical music. I think it crosses boundaries, that kind of like that show, for instance.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much indeed. I'm out of questions. I'm bereft of questions now. So thank you very much for your time.
I think I might be bereft of answers as well. It's lovely to talk to you,
And
John.
you. Thank you very much indeed. You've been listening to the Thoroughly Good Classical Music Podcast. My name is John Jacob. Follow Thoroughly Good on Twitter @ThoroughlyGood and on Instagram @Thoroughly_Good.